In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. What makes a person evil? Where does personal responsibility end when considering some of the worst crimes against humanity? These difficult questions are at the heart of our upcoming conversation with Dan Gretton, whose book, I, You, We, Them, looks at the psychology of individuals and corporations who played a part in some of the worst atrocities of the past 200 years, from the Holocaust to human rights violations in Nigeria. Dan spoke to Rachel Dilling.
So hi, Dan. It's great to have you on the podcast today. So we're talking about your book, I, You, We, Them, which looks at the psychology behind some of the less visible perpetrators of crimes against humanity in history. So talking about people that you call desk killers, these people who ordered and directed some of the worst atrocities in recent history. So I thought perhaps to start off, maybe you could define exactly what we mean when we use this term.
Yes,
desk
well, thank
killer.
thank you for the invitation to be here today, Rachel, and I'm delighted to be able to talk about the book with you. The term desk killer is actually one that I've used, and I'm trying to get that term into kind of really wide public debate now. I think it's been one of the most overlooked ideas in the whole of modern history, and I'm astonished that there's never been a definitive book on this subject until, you know, until Are You We Them, really. And the term, it comes from a German concept originally, and the term in German is that became it started to be used in the kind of early 1960s, and it's often people say it really came from the trial of Adolf Eichmann, the kind of bureaucratic organizer of parts of the Holocaust. And this term, Schreibtischtäter, it sort of translates in German as desk perpetrator. But the perpetrator side, the tater side, always has a sort of very negative connotation. So it's the idea of, you know, anybody involved in criminality would be a tater. But the fascinating thing for me is the idea of people who kill from their desks without needing to kill directly. And this, of course, is a term that is absolutely, it's not just about history. It's not just about the Holocaust. It's not just about colonial history. It's also about absolutely our world today. So people working in corporations today, people working potentially in an oil company, a pharmaceuticals company, an arms company, these are people who stay in their headquarters, whether it's in London or New York or Berlin, and they never see the victims they kill directly. They would never meet those people. And I've been compelled by this for more than 30 years by this subject of the Schreibtischtäter, or as I call them, the desk killers.
Yeah, it's an absolute mammoth book that you've written. I think it's over 1,000 pages, and it's, as you said, drawing on decades of research. But what was the thing that initially drew you to this topic? Was the sort of a pivotal moment for you that sparked
I mean, it is a huge book. I don't want that to be off-putting to people, because I've tried to write it in a very, very accessible way, more like reading a novel that you can't put down. That was my aim in the way I wrote it. There were really three. I'd take you through three moments that you could call light bulb moments in terms of the evolution of the ideas behind the book. The first moment came when I was really young. I mean, I'm now, you know, middle-aged guy, but this was just after I'd left university, in the mid to late 80s. And this film by a French director called Claude Lanzmann came out in 1986, called Shoah. And that film absolutely stunned me. I mean, it was 9.5 hours long. I went to see it over 2 days with a friend of mine. And there was one particular scene in that film. It's a series of interviews with perpetrators, survivors, and bystanders of the Holocaust. It's incredibly original because there's none of the usual footage. There's no footage of bodies. There's no archive footage used. It's simply interviews with people who are still alive. That's what made it remarkable. But in that film, Shoah, there was a memorandum that was read out, which was different to anything else in the film. And it was a memorandum written by one desk killer to another desk killer. And the language was so appalling, I couldn't get it out of my head. It was a kind of trauma moment. And this is the kind of language, the bureaucratic language that was used. Modifications to special vehicles now in service at Kulmhof, and for those now being built. Since December 1941, 97,000 have been processed by the three vehicles in service with no major incidents. A reduction in capacity seems necessary. This extends the operating time. The void must be filled with carbon monoxide. It was just a series of, you didn't know what this was about, this memorandum. You couldn't work out what it was about. And only slowly do you realise what it's describing is it's a communication from a man called Willy Joost to Obersturmbannführer Walter Rauf about how mobile gas chambers can be modified that were used in trucks made by a Swiss company, Saurer. How these trucks could be modified to become more efficient killing machines. And it says, as it says, 97,000 have already been killed. And I was so astounded at this kind of language, this bureaucratic language. And I was also astounded by the fact that it sounded very modern in a way. It could have been like one businessman writing to another businessman about improving profitability or something like that. So that was the first moment. I thought, how is it possible to use that kind of language about the killing of human beings, the organized killing of human beings? That was the first light bulb moment. The second light bulb moment happened about maybe 7 or 8 years later. And the company I was working with then, and I was one of the founders of Platform, we'd started looking at the environmental and human rights impacts of transnational corporations, particularly looking at the oil industry. And what was going on, for instance, in Nigeria with Shell in Nigeria and Chevron and some other companies in Nigeria. And it was extraordinary to us in Platform that in 1993, there were things going on which were just shocking. I mean, there was whole areas of the Niger Delta had been appallingly polluted. And Shell were kind of pretending it was just, you know, all there were just the occasional oil spill, but there was no major damage. It was total environmental devastation. And there began to be a campaign by the Ogoni people, led by an inspirational activist and writer called Ken Sarawiwa, who some of our older listeners may remember from the 1990s. He was a brilliant writer and a non-violent activist, I mean, a Gandhian activist. Anyway, for campaigning against the environmental degradation of his land, and for campaigning non-violently, in early 1993, he managed to get oil production stopped, halted. A staggeringly effective campaign. And of course, the Nigerian government, who were then a military government, and Shell, realised that this was threatening their massive profits. And so there was one of the most cynical things that have ever been done in the name of, you know, so-called justice. They organised a kind of trial on trumped-up charges against Ken Sarawiwa and eight colleagues. And these nine men, were sentenced to death at the end of a sham trial, which all legal observers said was one of the worst kind of kangaroo courts they'd ever seen. People thought the executions couldn't go ahead. Nelson Mandela was then an important person in terms of the Commonwealth, saying, you know, we need to use quiet diplomacy. And almost certainly, Shell could have prevented those executions going ahead. But people did nothing. I was absolutely, this second light bulb moment, what fascinated me more than anything else was imagining all the people in the Shell Centre in Waterloo, that was then at Waterloo on the South Bank. It was imagining them going into work the next day, business as usual. How do we protect the company? How can we keep the share price high? I mean, that's what absolutely gripped me, you know, and that was truly shocking to me. So that kind of compartmentalization, that was the second light bulb moment. And then the third, which happened in the late 90s, this is all of these three things happened before I started the really intensive 15 years, 20 years work of research. But the third light bulb moment happened reading an extraordinary book by Geeta Sereny that some of your listeners will know. And Geeta Sereny, really, she's best known for two incredible books, one on Franz Stangl, who was the commandant of Treblinka, and the other on Albert Speer, who was originally Hitler's architect and then became Hitler's minister for arms and war production in the war. And she spent 2 years with Speer and towards the end of his life and interviewing him in incredible detail about how it was that he, as a kind of technocrat and organizer in this monstrous machine, could actually think of himself as being, you know, not involved in the barbarity. And I became so fascinated by Speer. I did a lot of research on him. And there was a particular line in the book where Speer is talking about compartmentalization. Speer says this: Hitler required us not only to compartmentalize our activities, but also our thinking. He insisted that each man should only think about his task and not be concerned with that of his neighbor. And there was actually an order passed in January 1940, the General Order Number 1, which stated in this order, every man need only know what is going on in his own domain. And it was this idea of people operating in separate chambers where nobody actually asked questions outside their own chamber. And that was a moment where I realised, I mean, and Speer himself later said this, which is astonishing, thinking he was the person who did the Nuremberg rallies. He was the person who was such a brilliant organiser that some people say the war went on an extra year because of his, factory production methods and arms manufacturing methods. And this is what he said. He said, I felt myself to be Hitler's architect. Political events did not concern me. I felt there was no need for me to take any political positions at all. And in 1944, he writes to Hitler, the task I have to fulfil is an unpolitical one. I have felt at ease in my work only so long as my person and my work were evaluated solely by the standard of practical accomplishments. And then Speer says this, today it seems to me that I was trying to compartmentalise my mind. And that is the thing that I then thought, that's the key to these perpetrators, to the desk killers. It's compartmentalisation.
I want to revisit Albert Speer, actually. Obviously, he was tried at Nuremberg and he was one of the few that weren't executed. And that was partly because he accepted responsibility for his role. And then when he was imprisoned, there was this long process of him maybe coming to terms with it a bit more about what he actually was responsible for. What is your take on Albert Speer? Do you think that he did actually accept what he'd done? Or was he, during the whole time of the Second World War, was he tunnel visioned on his own task? Or do you think he did have broader knowledge of what was going on with the Holocaust and things like that?
I mean, that's a question that has occupied dozens of historians and hundreds of people over the last 75 years. I think the view now, it's very clear that Speer knew vastly more than he said at the time and immediately after the war. I mean, vastly more. And there's, of course, we now know that he was at Posen, at this incredibly important speech that Himmler made in Posen towards the end of the war, where Himmler talks about the decision to exterminate the Jews. Speer spent an enormous amount of time trying to pretend, getting a chauffeur to do an affidavit that he'd left the meeting before Himmler made that speech. We now know that's not true. So there's no doubt that Speer knew more. But I also think, because he spent the vast majority of his time in Berlin, in the ministerial headquarters, that he very, very rarely was confronted directly with the results of his actions, with the results of his work. And there, in fact, there's an extraordinary moment. It's a moment I talked about with Geeta Sereny. I only met her once, sadly, but we had this really extraordinary conversation. And we both talked about this moment when Speer, in late 1943, he visits Dora, which was a V2 manufacturing plant for the V2 rockets in the Harz Mountains. And it's one of the only times when Speer is directly confronted by the kind of horror of what his war machine has kind of unleashed. And he can see people dead at the side of the works as he's going into this mountain underground factory. And he can see, he actually looks into the eyes of these slave labourers. And of course, they're his slave labourers. And it's a staggering moment. And it's a moment that afterwards, he has a kind of physical and mental breakdown, which lasts for many weeks in December, in December 43 and early 44. And it's the moment, he says, when he's talking to Sereny, and he writes about this as well, that when he realises it at the end of the war, that, in his words, that he then thinks Hitler's kind of unhinged. And in the very last months of the war, he actually began to countermand Hitler's orders for kind of destroying things. Because Hitler had this, in the last months, when he knew the war was lost, he had this idea of, you know, well, if Germany doesn't have the ability to win this war, then it should be destroyed. And it was a kind of extraordinarily narcissistic thing. He was going to die. He knew he was going to commit suicide. He wanted to take Germany with him. And Speer began to kind of go against that, as did some of the other people in the high command. But, you know, how do we judge Speer? I think it's extraordinarily poignant that when he was in Spandau for those 20 years, there was a moment of about 2 to 3 years early on in his sentence where I believe he genuinely attempted to understand what had happened to him and how he had become involved in this monstrous project. He just begins to open up some kind of conversation and dialogue with this a man I write about, this Protestant priest called Casalis, which I write about quite a lot in the book. And there's this sense of Casalis asks him to open his mind and spirit to suffering and gives him an incredible reading list to try and become a human being again. And Speer actually says, "Will you help me to become a different man?" And that, whatever you think of Speer, is an extraordinary moment in this man's life. And I think it was then reversed. When he was released, he became a kind of media celebrity. And a lot of that brilliant work that Casalis had done was kind of jettisoned. But there was this I don't know if you got that feeling from reading the book. There's this moment where you see an opening in Speer.
That was something that really struck me when I was reading some of his diary entries, which you include, where he's got this, it's seemingly quite large capacity for self-reflection that even he sort of admitted was quite surprising, because he'd previously been this very sort of statistical, mathematical man who, and he even said it himself, like, can't relate to other humans. Even his friends and family, he's quite closed off. I think he speaks about admiring Hitler because Hitler was very charming and able to make someone feel special, and he could not relate to that quality. But then when he's in prison, he sits there and he reflects on his personality and why he might be a certain way. And as I was reading it, I was kind of annoyed with myself, because I was thinking, I don't want to feel empathy towards this man, but I couldn't help feeling like a bit of his humanity coming through in those entries.
But I think that's I don't think you should feel annoyed with yourself there at all, Rachel, because I think it's what you're talking about here is the human capacity for empathy. And I think one of the things I love more than anything about Geeta Sereny's work is she was really heavily criticised, particularly by historians, for the work on Stengel and Speer, because some people felt she got too close to her subject, both of those subjects. And yet I have a completely different view to that. I think she realises if we are going to really understand the minds of perpetrators, we have to go beyond the labels and we have to see people's humanity. And there's this real dichotomy we have when we're looking at perpetrators. And it's absolutely exemplified by these lines in a book by the German writer Bernard Schlink. He writes this in The Reader. And I've always thought these lines go to the heart of the matter. He's writing in this book about a woman who's done an appalling crime in the Second World War, a German woman that the narrator has got very close to, a woman called Hannah. And he finds out then she's responsible for this barbaric crime. And then he writes this: "I wanted simultaneously to understand Hannah's crime and to condemn it, but it was too terrible for that. When I tried to understand it, I had the feeling I was failing to condemn it as it must be condemned. When I condemned it as it must be condemned, there was no room for understanding." So if we want to condemn, which I completely understand, and as somebody who's spent years and years in activism, I have moments of rage and fury about the world and how it's operated and in whose interests it's operated. But I know if I start to condemn totally, all my humanity disappears. And I think it's incredibly important that we St. Augustine said, you hate the sin, not the sinner. And I think that is extraordinary. We have to look at the sin, the action, the crime, the responsibility. Look at that relentlessly. But keep in mind the human being as well. Always keep in mind the human being.
Still to come, on the History Extra podcast.
This fascinates me, the way that the Deschylers have never received the kind of justice that direct killers receive. If you were a young guard at a concentration camp and shot somebody trying to escape, a lot of those people were executed after the war. If you were a senior organiser in the German civil service, you had a suspended sentence for 2 or 3 years and then were reintegrated into German society. I mean, staggering, staggering difference in how justice was not done.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Well, it's quite interesting. We love to label people evil. I mean, we label serial killers evil all the time, and true crime's so popular. But it's actually, like, on that theme, it's quite an othering act to be like, this person is an evil person, because it sets them apart from us. And I think in your book, because it's looking at people who are making these decisions that result in deaths from, you know, from their desk or behind closed doors, they're actually maybe a bit closer to us than we'd care to think. So I think that's a really important thing to hold on to, is like looking for, why is this happening? Would I make that decision if I was in the right set of circumstances and the right organisation? Would I be complicit in something that I never would dream of being, just have sat here looking at it all objectively? But when you're like a wheel in a cog, I don't know.
I mean, absolutely. You've nailed it. I mean, you know, that in a way is music to my ears, because the way I've written the book, it's absolutely asking every reader not just to look at the world in a different way, but to look at their own life and to look at their own responsibilities and to look at their own ethics. And I've always felt, you know, just to use that term evil is such an astonishing act of laziness. I mean, whenever it's used, often in the tabloid media, it's just laziness, because you say evil and then there's no need to you know, analyze, really understand, do the work, the hard work, the mental work. I think you're completely right about that. I mean, there's a whole passage about how we look at perpetrators, and I quote Primo Levi and Hannah Arendt, who are two of the greatest writers on this subject. Primo Levi says this about people we consider evil now in Nazi Germany. We must remember that these faithful followers were not born torturers, were not monsters. They were ordinary men. Monsters exist, but they are too few in number to be truly dangerous. More dangerous are the common men, the functionaries, ready to believe and act without asking questions. And Hannah Arendt said this: the trouble with Eichmann was precisely that so many were like him, and that the many were neither perverted nor sadistic, and that they were and still are terribly and terrifyingly normal. From the viewpoint of our legal institutions and of our moral standards of judgment, this normality was much more terrifying than all of the atrocities put together. And I would argue that we're still in that place where we can't see the normality of these terrifying perpetrators. We can't look and analyse that. We haven't developed a language yet to do that. And so, of course, people retreat to these words like evil, which are just a lazy shorthand, almost without meaning.
Absolutely. I mean, you speak about this when you describe the events of the Wannsee Conference, which is when a group of Nazi leadership came together to discuss what they termed the final solution. And the thing that struck you about it was how many of them were doctors and university educated. What was it that What was it that you were thinking when you were looking at this information about these people?
I mean, this started with, I was in Washington at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and it started there because I was in, there'd been, this was late 90s, and the museum had just opened. And a lot of, there'd been a lot of discussion about this particular exhibit, which was footage of Einsatzgruppen killing on the Eastern Front. And there was discussion about whether it should be shown or not. And I went into the room where this film was playing, and there were probably 20 or 30 people clustered around this, watching this film, shocking film. And I wasn't interested in watching those images. I just thought, I'm not, you know, I'd seen them before, I thought, isn't it fascinating? Because of all the media focus on that, everybody was now looking at that footage. And I went over to the other side of the room, and there was a single sheet of A4 paper, you know, a single sheet of paper with the names of the 15 men who had attended the Wannsee conference in January 1942. And the thing that staggered me, some of those were names that we would know, like Eichmann, like Müller, the head of the Gestapo. But most of them were names I hadn't heard of at the time. And eight of these men out of 15, eight of them were doctor. And had doctorates, had PhDs. And it's possibly because I'm from a family of academics. I mean, my dad was a classicist at UCL, and my grandfather was a historian, actually. And so it's probably maybe partly for that reason. I was kind of absolutely appalled that half of the organisers of the Holocaust at this meeting were, you know, highly academic men. And so I started doing a lot of research on them. And at that time, you know, when I started doing research on this, there was no, you couldn't just Google things. You couldn't just stay in your, this was legwork. This was going to archives in Berlin and in London and Washington. You know, this was doing a lot of legwork. And I did a lot of work at the Wiener Library in London, a brilliant Holocaust library. And I found out there was such limited information on these perpetrators. And it's taken until, I mean, this book came out only, I think, 2017. It's taken more than 75 years after the end of the war for a book to come out on the people who organised the Holocaust at the Wannsee. This book called The Participants by Hans Christian Jasch and Christoph Kreutzmüller. And you know, but when I started, there was almost nothing available, so I had to piece things together. And I found out about these men. I mean, they were more than half of these doctors, I think five of them, had law doctorates. They were lawyers. And these were the men who met in this villa that I describe in this particular chapter in the book. And they sat around a table and discussed how an entire racial group could be exterminated, as well as Sinti and Roma and other minorities. And it just, again, and the judgment on these people, Rachel. I mean, after the war, three of those senior figures, people who co-authored the Nuremberg race laws, people who, Martin Bormann's deputy, these people, they were given suspended sentences. Some of them were released for time already served, 3 years. 1.5 years. They lived until the 1980s. One of them died in 1987. They became, you know, pillars of the community again. And this fascinates me, the way that the death killers have never received the kind of justice that direct killers receive. If you were a young guard at a concentration camp and shot somebody trying to escape, a lot of those people were executed after the war. If you were a senior organiser in the German civil service, you had a suspended sentence for 2 or 3 years and then were reintegrated into German society. I mean, staggering, staggering difference in how justice was not done.
It's kind of interesting the cognitive dissonance that some of these people had about what they'd done as well when they were confronted about it. So you write about Eichmann in particular, when he was on trial in Jerusalem in 1961, and someone accused him of murdering, he was furious at this accusation because he, you know, technically hadn't physically killed anyone with his own hands. And I think he said, "I never killed a Jew or non-Jew for that matter. I never killed a human being." And yet he was one of the key people at the Wannsee conference who was sat there making those decisions about death camps and transportation and all of that. And he did not display any awareness that he'd been involved. It was literally wiping his hands of it. And it's quite astonishing, that psychological leap. But
as you say, I mean, that's a brilliant example of cognitive dissonance. I mean, that somebody could be involved in organising the machinery of the genocide and yet be appalled at the idea that he was being accused of being individually violent. I mean, it's staggering. And yet maybe that's, again, a kind of human way of protecting yourself, that we, you know, all of us have these images, all of us, I'm sure, have these images of ourselves, which may be radically at odds with the reality that other people might see. I mean, that's the slightly scary thing in this. But we can see it, we can very clearly see it with perpetrators often, that there's these so many ways of deflecting personal responsibility. I mean, so many ways where, you know, you can pretend to yourself that you haven't seen something, that you can pretend to yourself that you're not responsible. I mean, in the book, there's the section where we should probably explain to listeners that I spent about a year, actually 18 months in some cases, setting up interviews with people at really senior levels who had worked in the oil industry. And I was wanting to exactly tease out how much people know, how much people don't want to actually see what they know is going on. And so those interviews are, and I'd like to do more of those with really people involved at senior levels in companies. And really look at this question, because people, I think deep down, they do understand if they're being asked about this, not in an accusatory way, because I was very, very warm in those interviews. I was very human, very empathetic. And I think people were surprised. They expected me to come at them with these hard questions. And actually, what I was trying to get them to talk about was how idealistic they were as children, how fascinated they were in geology, and how, but step by step by step by step by step, they became involved in a company that was doing barbaric things in another part of the world. And they were then in a position where they had to justify those actions and all the myriad psychological methods by which people can try and justify, which I try and talk about in the book. And I have these 10... There are these 10 criteria that I talk about that I don't think anybody has ever really... I mean, I wrote them as these 10 criteria as a kind of challenge to people, organisational psychologists, activists, to all of us, to start to look in a really analytical way at what are the methods by which people take away responsibility from their actions and deliberately do not see things.
I mean, this is one of my questions for you, actually. What steps does a person go through that means they're able to rationalise being either indirectly complicit or actively directing something, you know, directing a great evil, ultimately?
I mean, they're not, of course, the factors are not the same in all the cases. That, you know, there are unique situations and contexts. The 10 factors which enable people in organisations to kill number one, incrementalism, that the dozens of little steps from one thing to the next where you can't actually see what's happened. You know, you step by step by step by step. And in the book, I use the example of Stengel, who became the commandant of Treblinka, but him starting off as a boy, actually as a basket weaver in Austria. And then he gets a position in with the police. He doesn't get on with his boss in the police, so he's asked for a transfer, and he's transferred to a euthanasia killing centre. And then it's step by step by step, like 22 steps in his case. And he was a Catholic. He was a very serious Catholic as well, which is pretty astounding to end up as the commandant at Treblinka with 1.2 million people being exterminated where you're working. You know, I mean, so incrementalism, that's one. The second one is what I call normalization and peer conformity. So how we look at all the people around us. And if people around you accept something, then you tend to, it's extraordinarily hard to go against what everybody else around you, your peers, are accepting. That the case study I give there are the doctors who worked at Auschwitz. And that was remarkable, the way that the doctors who'd taken the Hippocratic Oath end up in a process of selecting people for the gas chambers. I mean, that's staggering. But the way that that was done through a process of alcohol, through a process of people having mentors, junior doctors being given senior doctors to talk through their ethical problems with. I mean, staggering.
Wasn't there one doctor who said, I actually wrote it down, one doctor said it was only possible to be human for the first minute of being in the concentration camp. You had to become numb very quickly.
Yes, there was this little window. You could call it a window of humanity. And then once you went through that window, it was impossible to go back. You were so implicated then. I mean, absolutely that. Then the issues about the dehumanization of language, how the victim is abstractified, how it's so many examples I've seen, people stop seeing individual human beings, and what you see is an abstract mass of people. This is why the book is called Are You We Them? Because once you start seeing a collective them, then genocide can begin. Once you have made people into objects, genocide can begin. So that's really important. Distancing yourself from the act of violence, exactly what you talked about with your example of Eichmann getting so angry at his trial that he'd been accused of killing this young boy, Hungarian boy. So he was actually distancing himself from the direct act of violence without realising that, of course, the violence he was unleashing was a totally different level from his office, from his desk. And then perhaps the most important criteria, transferring personal responsibility to the authority's responsibility. And this is where things like the Milgram test in obedience to authority comes in. And this is also where I'm fascinated in terms of modern corporations, the way that so many corporations in the late 90s and early noughties started talking about corporate social responsibility, CSR, and they began to have departments in their company which would look at the ethics and the environmental issues. And the huge problem with that is that because there was then a specialist department that was dealing with that, it actually takes away the individual responsibility from the ordinary worker, the ordinary executive. And because they can say, oh, well, there's a whole other department dealing with that, ethics, CSR, we don't have to think about that stuff. And then compartmentalization of thought, a culture of workaholism, prioritization of abstract systems over human beings, and looking away, or what I call willful ignorance. So those are the 10, those are sort of 10 factors which you see again and again in perpetrators. And all of them really need to be examined. And in the next book, I'll be looking at in more detail at those as well. But those are just some of the analysis.
Something in your book that I'd never really thought about, basically, until I had actually read your book, was the level of involvement of corporations in the logistics of the Holocaust. So you mentioned right at the start of the book this Swiss company who were providing these mobile gas chambers, and it's a company that's still in existence today, and they don't acknowledge this part of their history necessarily. So a question I wanted to ask you was, do you think that corporations involved with the Holocaust or had a role to play in the Holocaust and the organisation of it, have they done enough to recognise that, and have they done enough to make amends for that?
No, I mean, absolutely not. I mean, the way we look at history is sometimes so limited. I'm astonished at our inability sometimes to see massive realities that are almost there, but we don't look at them. One of the most inspirational quotes I ever read, and which helped me in my research enormously, comes in a book by W.G. Sebald called Austerlitz. And Sebald's protagonist in the book, at the end of a description of a battle, he writes this brilliant, brilliant sentence. He says, "Our concern with history is a concern with preformed images already printed on our brains, images at which we keep staring while the truth lies elsewhere, away from it all, somewhere as yet undiscovered." And the whole of the work I've been doing the last 20 years has been looking at that. The truth lies elsewhere, somewhere as yet undiscovered. And I look, I mean, really, my book is an alternative history of the Holocaust, where I'm looking at the most powerful forces in the society at the time, which were, of course, corporations. And this is embodied by a single walk that I do with my colleague Jay in the book, where we go from the most known part of Auschwitz that 99.5% of people, when they visit Auschwitz, go to, which is where the main museum is. And that was the political camp, camp number one. Some visitors to Auschwitz go to Birkenau, where the gas chambers were, to the west of the town. Almost nobody, a matter of a few dozen people a year, do the walk that I did with Jay across the town of Oswiecim, about 4 kilometres. And there is something so staggering in the eastern part of Auschwitz, Oswiecim today, and it's still there today. The biggest complex built by the second biggest transnational corporation in the world in the 1940s, who were IG Farben, vast German pharmaceuticals company, who had today, they're still kind of in existence in a way today, because today they're Bayer, Agfa, Herx, BASF. So they're still German companies, but they were split up after the war. In the war, this was the biggest company in Germany, hugely powerful. Without IG Farben, Hitler could not have waged the Second World War. And in Auschwitz, they built this vast chemical complex to try and manufacture synthetic fuels and synthetic rubber. And this is where Elie Wiesel and Primo Levi were slave labourers, 30,000 of them. It was what we would today call a public-private partnership between the SS and IG Farben. IG Farben paid for the camp, and then they basically rented out the slave labourers to the SS. And about 30,000 people died, exterminated through work. Now, I'm not saying it's not important to look at the Auschwitz that we do know, and the piles of shoes, and the piles of, and the piles of briefcases, suitcases, and the gas chambers. Of course. But what I'm saying, by using that quotation from Sebald, is that we've got an entirely distorted view of, without looking at the corporations, without looking at IG Farben properly, without looking, even more than IG Farben, without looking at companies like Deutsche Bank, Allianz, the insurance company. All the concentration camps were insured. Allianz profited from insurance premiums. Allianz is still a massively successful insurance company today. They've never properly looked at their responsibility for the Holocaust. Deutsche Bank lent vast sums of money, loans, to actually build Auschwitz. And they were involved in the dispossession of Jewish assets hugely. I mean, so financial companies, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and, you know, I don't think this aspect of the Holocaust has ever had the attention it deserves.
Why do you think that it's been overlooked so long? Do you think we have a tendency that we want to blame an individual? Like we want to be like, oh, it was Hitler and he was this madman, evil psychopath. And it's almost easier for us to be like, the whole thing was this one guy's idea and it won't happen again because we won't let a psychopath get into power. Rather than be like, actually, there were so many different spider webs interlinking and that's a more complex picture. I think you're right.
I think it's so much easier to look at individuals rather than huge systems. Towards the end of the book, I trace the way that our understanding of the Holocaust has moved from looking at the diary of Anne Frank, so the suffering of a single girl in Holland, the huge success of that after the war, and then it took another 50 years. Before the first book started to be written about certain corporations, you know, corporations and Nazi Germany. And I think one of the problems, a huge problem we've got is it actually the capacity of the human brain? And when I was working on the early research into IG Farben, I came across I had a research assistant working with me for a few months, and he found in the Vienna Library transcripts of the trial of IG Farben after the war. And this single transcript came to something like 20,000 or 30,000 pages, and we just started laughing because we realised that, you know, it would take 10 of us. If I had 10 people, 10 researchers, to be able to read simply that, to understand that single company and its responsibility in the war, it would take teams of people. And systems are so vast that it almost defeats the human brain, that kind of scale. And in the book, you'll remember towards the end of the book, I quote the great American historian of the Holocaust, Raoul Hilberg. And in one of his last books, he simply prints, if we are to truly understand the Holocaust, we have to look at how all of these agencies work together. And over about three pages, he just lists all the different organisations and the ministries and the companies and the, you know, all the different agencies. And I think, again, we're at the beginning of this process to be able to look at how all of these things fit together. As you use this phrase about a spider's web. I mean, it is like the vast web, the biggest web you can imagine, and how things all fit together. And I think it's very, very hard for us to see that, for our minds to encompass that, I suppose. That's a rather long answer to your question, which is very pertinent and, you know, we need to think about more.
We've talked a bit about the psychology of individuals, the idea of an ordinary in inverted commas person and how they could come to commit an awful crime or something. We haven't talked about maybe people who went
there
against
are examples.
The grain.
There are some examples of people who refused to go along with orders. Daniel Goldhagen talks about one of the myths of the Holocaust is that you couldn't be transferred out of your unit if you were appalled at what you'd been ordered to do. It used to be said that, you know, if you didn't obey the orders, you would be shot. Now, a lot of research in the last 10 to 20 years has shown that that's actually quite untrue. And there were people in the security units and the police units who had been asked to commit killings of civilians, executions on the Eastern Front, who did request transfers, and they were transferred. And you know, so this, I think that's really important, that research that's been done in the last, I would say, two decades, because that really breaks down this idea that you couldn't refuse to obey orders. There's an example, an incredibly powerful example of a man who witnessed the an Einsatzgruppen killing. And actually then he became one of the people who testified after the war. And it's staggeringly moving. It's one of the most moving accounts I've ever read. of the Holocaust. And he's watching the family undressing. And this man, he was a businessman. And astonishingly, he was allowed to get close enough to see these killings. And he's watching this family undressing, and he's watching a father pointing to the sky with his son in his arms, and he's watching the grandmother. And it's one of the most powerful pieces ever written down. And that only came to light because of this man's courage, this ordinary German businessman's courage. I write about that in the next book, actually. But there are examples of people, but they were so rare in the context of the 99.9% of people who went along with the orders, who didn't question. So we're talking about something very special in a tiny percentage of people who actually said that their humanity, their ethics, was not going to stop them, was in fact going to mean they had to do something, they had to bear witness. But it's extraordinarily rare in the context of the Holocaust.
There was a case that I was reading in your book, I think it was yesterday, that I found incredibly moving, which was, I can't remember which camp it was in, but it was in one of the gas chambers, and a young girl, I think she was 15 or 16, had survived. And so they went in and saw that she was still alive. And for some reason, it kind of humanized the people in the moment. They were like, oh, it's a 15-year-old girl. And they brought her out, and the doctors gave her, did they give
her
food?
Yes, that comes, it's a Hungarian doctor called Naizli who describes that. And he was working as a doctor in a unit next to the gas chambers. And that's an example of what we were talking about earlier, where just for a moment, instead of being a mass, a group, collective group of victims, this girl becomes an individual and she's still breathing. And they bring her back to life and they give her soup. And of course, then they realize a couple of hours later, when she's been revived, of course, the horrific thing is they realise the senior person comes around and she cannot be allowed to live because she's a witness. So she's then shot. I mean, it's a devastating, devastating account in the book. And but again, that's, yeah, I mean, they thought there would be no witnesses. That's the extraordinary thing. They actually thought they could commit a crime on this scale, and nobody would believe people who were left afterwards. And they tried to eradicate, of course. And the way the Sonderkommandos were set up, as you'll know, is that the people who were actually the Jewish prisoners who were working in the Sonderkommandos in the extermination camps, in the gas chambers, every month, all of those people were killed and a new group were then put in their place, precisely to stop the witnessing. And some of them did survive, but a tiny number. And some of that testimony is the most important testimony we've got on the Holocaust, because, a matter of, I think, a dozen maybe of those people who worked in the Sonderkommandos actually survived and gave extraordinary accounts. People like Philip Müller, a brilliant book by one of the survivors of the Sonderkommandos.
I guess my final question to you, and you've touched on it already, but what message do you really want people to take from it? What's the fundamental message you want people to take away from your book?
I'd like people to think about the nature of responsibility and how we never have held authorities to account properly for their actions. And that means governments, that means corporations, that means any kind of authority system. And we haven't been asking the right questions so far. And I wanted through this book to start to give people a language where they could begin to ask incredibly searching questions of anybody in authority or anybody in an organization wielding power. Because I don't think we've begun to ask the right questions so far. And if this book contributes to that process in any way, it will have succeeded.
That was Dan Gretton. His book, I, You, We, Them, Revealing the Desk Killers, Perpetrators of Crimes Against Humanity, is out now, published by Penguin Books. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.